Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Today, abortion is a crime in every American state unless it is done to save the mother's life, or in the case of a few states, to preserve her health, as the phrase goes. But as we all know, abortion certainly does go on illegally in this nation. Some of my sources say that the police generally consider illegal abortion to be the third biggest racket in the United States, ranking only behind gambling and narcotics. Nobody seems to know how many illegal abortions go on in a given year. My figures here range from 750,000 to about 2 million. Nobody seems to know exactly how many women die in the course of these illegal abortions. Some estimates put the figure as high as 5,000. Yet the subject is little discussed. Many newspapers, I notice, still refer to an illegal abortion simply as illegal surgery. Today, the Open Mind enters into a discussion of this question with this panel. Here to my left, the Reverend Robert H. Smith, pastor of the Church of Our Redeemer in Chappaqua, New York, and a member of the faculty of Concordia College in Bronxville, New York. Next to the Reverend Smith, and to my immediate left, Dr. Ellen F. Guttmacher, president of Planned Parenthood World Population and former director of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Here to my right, Dr. Lewis P. James, chief of the Obstetrical and Gynecological Department of the St. Francis Hospital in Hartford, Connecticut. Next to Dr. James, Mrs. Ellis S. Rossi, research associate of the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago and a specialist in the problems of women. And to my far right, Mr. Caleb Foote, professor of family and criminal law at the University of Pennsylvania, who is presently at work on a scholarly study of this abortion problem. Dr. James, I wonder if you would get us headed into what seems to me a central feature of this problem, all the moral implications involved in it, by commenting on an actual case which comes from one of my sources. It occurred to a young nurse who was on the night shift of her hospital. She was going home. She was attacked and raped. The chief of obstetrics at that hospital called the DA's office, and the chief of obstetrics said that he recommended an abortion. The DA said that if the DA's office knew about it, they would have to prosecute. The chief of obstetrics presented the case to a board of physicians in his hospital. All the physicians voted that the abortion should be performed. It was performed, though, of course, illegally.
Well, this is a rather common affair, the performance of an abortion for a rape case. It's done on the part of those physicians because they think that this is going to do mental injury or some sort of trauma mentally to this patient. I would suggest that the trauma is already there as a result of the rape. And I don't know whether by compounding it with the destruction of a human being, this lady is going to be any better off, if as well as she was at the beginning.
Then, Doctor, had you been on this board of physicians, you would have voted no.
I would have voted no.
Dr. Guttmacher,
well, I can say that in non-Catholic hospitals, perhaps 25% would have done this abortion. 75% probably would not. My own hospital, when I was at Mount Sinai, we would not. Unfortunately, I think, felt that this did not involve the woman's life, and therefore rape was not an indication, since we were carrying out the law as we thought that it should be administered. I deprecate such a narrow point of view because my own feeling is that there are several things involved. We forget in the formula the unborn child, and it seems to me it's a tragic occurrence to be born an unwanted child, the cause of my being a case of rape. Second, of course, one thing is the criminal act, which obviously traumatizes the woman, but to live with this act for 9 full months and then have to go through the rigors of labor and be penalized further for this seems to me is undue cruel punishment. And my feeling is that I would not hesitate, if I had full command of the situation, to carry out if the rape is proved.
In this case, you, as the gentleman in charge of that division of the hospital, would have voted and instructed.
But my board would have been against it.
But you personally would have been for it.
Personally, I would have been for it, but I would have been voted down.
This raises a very interesting fact that I think all existing studies show, and that is the present law of so-called therapeutic abortion. The views of doctors and of hospital boards differ so widely that really what is the law has been transferred into the discretion of the medical profession. It's quite an extraordinary situation. A similar hypothetical case was put to 26 hospital boards in California, reported by an article, a couple of Stanford people, Packer and Gamble. And of that group of hospitals, 15 would have approved the abortion in a rape case, and 7 would have disapproved it. Of the 15 who would have approved it, most thought that some other hospital would probably carry out the abortion. There's an extraordinary range in practice among the medical profession in this area.
Mrs. Rossi?
Yes, I was going to refer to the same study that of the 7 who disapproved, 3 thought that they would, another hospital in the state would approve.
But which I interpret to mean that those 3 thought that although they wouldn't do it, it was within the medically permissible range of judgment, although under California law it was patently illegal under the law as it operates. And I'm interested that Dr. Guttmacher, in reaching his resolution of what he would do, made no mention of the law at all. It was what he would do if he had control of the situation in the hospital via the rest of his board.
Well, excuse me, Reverend Smith, now from the point of view of the moral aspects of this particular case, is that what you were going to comment on?
No, I would like to comment rather on this, and I hope I'm not throwing a monkey wrench into your plans with your questions. Here is a case which is, you know, for an opener on a program like this, it's a real grabber. And it immediately, I think, prejudices the whole thing that we're talking about. You say that there are between 750,000 and 2 million illegal abortions in this country a year.
Those are the best figures.
Yeah, the best figures, and that's a wide range. In how many of those cases was the pregnancy the direct cause of a criminal assault? Such as in the case which you...
I have no information on that.
I think this is
very small. This, of course, in terms of incidence and much less the problem of what was the precipitating cause for it would be very difficult to ascertain.
Yeah.
But from what evidence we do have, this could only be a very small proportion. Most of these illegal abortions are conducted by on married women. And if we can judge by the findings from other countries, we would suspect that the same pattern holds in the United States. With increasing age of the woman and with the increasing size of her family, the higher would be the incidence of illegal abortion.
Now, I have heard figures something like this, that 90% of all abortions would be performed on women who are married and have 5 or 6 children already.
No, 3 or more.
3 or more. 3 or more. You know, I think this throws a different light on it, maybe a more objective light, and maybe
you
it makes
feel
the
this
thing
particular
a little less
case prejudices things in favor of legalizing abortion.
I think immediately emotion is on the side of this young lady, and I think that if in Protestant circles, if there is any thought for relaxing somewhat the abortion laws in our country, it would be a relaxation in favor of including humanitarian abortion. Aborting a child or interrupting a pregnancy which had been caused by rape or incest or some
sort. Well, the Reverend Smith, I did not intend, of course, to prejudice the case in
I'm
any
sure
way
you did
at
not.
All. I took this as what I thought an extreme instance which would bring out and permit you gentlemen who have, I think, moral objections to abortions under any circumstances to show that even in this kind of case there is still a moral objection. Now, is that correctly your position?
I think that that moral objection has been stated by Dr. James.
You agree with this.
And I must agree with it. And it's hardest to agree. You know, hardest as a human being, hardest as a pastor and minister to people, hardest as a father to agree in this case that it really is morally objectionable.
Well, the other extreme case, of course, the other extreme position is a legalization of all abortions.
Absolutely.
Within some range where the operation remains relatively simple, I suppose the first 3 or 4 months of pregnancy when a DNC or something
weeks.
Is still possible. And this I suppose poses the other extreme from the one you threw
yes.
out.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an extreme that I personally would adopt.
Well, I don't think that either Dr. James or the Reverend Smith, and I didn't give you a chance, and we should do it now. You have stated a moral objection, but you have not explained to us what the moral objection is in any of these cases.
I think the moral objection is obvious, the destruction of a human being.
It's simply
which may, could be almost classified as homicide.
Could I say on that that this is, in my opinion, simply untenable under legal standards? We even if the child is born alive and is then killed, which was of course is still I suppose a more common problem than perhaps we would admit, and was a very common problem a couple of centuries ago, a devastating problem in Europe. Even in this situation, the law, which regards the sanctity of life very highly, draws sharp lines and regards this as a much less serious offense in theory and an even less serious offense in practice. And I think if the law is in accord with public opinion in this area, that even after the child has been born, the taking of life is not on the same level as the taking of a life of an adult person. And where is in the cases we're talking about, where the abortion would be performed during the first few months of pregnancy, I think the ordinary common view of the situation is still more different.
I'm not as clear in my mind, Mr. Foote. Now, on the law, you are saying to Dr. James that legally he's just wrong, that morally or religiously he may be right, but that the law in the 50 states unanimously does not hold.
I didn't say the 50 states. I said that most of these are foreign laws. In practice in this country, it is certainly true. I suppose our practice, the only figures I have are for England, but I would suppose our practice is similar, where in fact women who are convicted of murdering their child shortly after the birth of the child, the figures I remember are for 1955, there were 13 such convictions in England. Two of those women were sent to prison, one for 1 year and one for 3 years, and the other 11 were released, either
well,
on probation
States,
or released
though?
Outright. And I don't know what the status is in the United States, but I'm sure that this, the same feeling that this is a much less serious thing, a more pardonable thing by the mother, exists in this country. And I think that if you go back to the earlier stages, it's still more true. What is the rate of spontaneous abortions, of what we laymen call natural miscarriages? It must be, what, 10-20% of all pregnancies?
10% are recognized, but probably actually 30% of conceptions are aborted. Some in such an early stage, they can't be recognized as an abortion.
I think the woman's... Could I just say one other thing on this? I think the woman's attitude to such a spontaneous abortion, I think a typical woman's attitude is not the regret over the loss of a child or the loss of a life, but regret over the loss of the chance to become a mother of the child. I think it's an entirely different species of grief and of regret, and that this reflects general opinion.
I think we have to insert here that there's a difference in various religions about this. I mean, obviously, in the Shintoist religion, for example, the child has no rights until the child is born, from the point of view of legal or moral or ethical rights. In the Talmud, in Judaism, one could destroy the child in utero for necessity. It had no rights until a head was born of the child. So that I think you have to put this thing in its proper context. We all, of course, are affected by the more or less Christian theology. We have this surrounds us, and we feel very strongly. Many of us are very deeply affected by this. So I think that what is the difference of opinion very often can be on the basis of one's environment and religious and so forth and so on.
Well, to try to clarify this religious matter now... I think we could all agree that within the realm of Catholic thinking, and you, sir, are of the Catholic faith,
abortion is simply inadmissible. There's no
correct.
Possible. Now, when you get over to the Protestant field, it isn't that clear, is it? You are
it's
a minister of the Lutheran
faith, Church.
Is it clear even about Lutherans, not to speak of all Protestants?
No. As a matter of fact, it's only been in the last 12 years that there has been a consensus on the matter of contraception. And all of a sudden, this problem is, being brought to the light of day. And there simply have not been any detailed, realistic, hard studies made of this question. The books of Christian ethics in the Protestant Church don't even have the word abortion in the index. It's very, very difficult to find any kind of...
Is there any way you could generalize for us as between the various denominations, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, and so forth? Does one of them lean more toward...
As far as I can see, abortion is mentioned... only in the same breath with infanticide, and it is condemned as evil and as tragic. And it's just stated that way, and not too much is said about it. The one thing that may be said is that, although it is hard to be sentimental about a fetus, as Dr. Foote has mentioned, this is still a human life. This life, this fetus is human life, and we dare not assume that we can have dominion over this human life, that belongs to God. And yet, detailed studies have not been done. And there is a consensus, I think, or a feeling among the Protestants that we would like to find some reason. We would like to find some reason
to legalize
to make some exceptions, some exceptions.
Well, I think you're overstating the situation. I'm a practitioner of 40 years' experience, and, of course, meeting this problem head on. And certainly I've had innumerable Protestant couples come to me and talk over the problem. And, if, for instance, if it involves a case of rubella, the woman having had German measles, every one of them are anxious to have the pregnancy terminated simply on the figure of one chance in five of the child having a serious malformation. You make it seem as though therapeutic abortion, for real, honest-to-goodness reason, is not applauded by the Protestant. In my association with Protestants, it's absolutely 100%.
The question was, what does the Church say? What are the official statements? And
well, I can
very,
say what the parishioner says.
Things.
You're saying what the Church.
I can agree with you on
yes,
that.
Yes, surely.
I would certainly
Dr.
Agree
James
with you.
Wanted to come in. I'll get to you in a moment, Mr. Ross. Yes.
About the rubella, it just seems only fair play that if you're going to have 4-1 good babies, you would play with the 4.
Well, if you're going to be a parent, I'd be darned if I want to play with a 20% likelihood of a malformed baby. That's a terrible life for a baby. If it's born congenitally blind or deaf or microcephalic or serious cardiac disease or some other anomaly, I can't agree with you. I mean, you and I are friends. We can disagree pleasantly with each other. But I wouldn't accept that your statement that this is a... My feeling is if it's only 10%, it's still a tremendous risk to take.
Yes, I would second what Dr. Goodmarcus says, that I think every woman should be entitled to have a very happy experience with her pregnancy and have a whole long lifetime. If she has 3 children, and that's what she wants, she is entitled to having 3 happy experiences with pregnancy and childbirth. And if it is her considered opinion, and her husband agrees with her, that since there is a 20% chance of some malformation in this fetus, then if she decides, I want to abort this one and have another chance for bearing a healthy third child, if it's the third child she's expecting, I think that she should have the right to make such a decision and to have such an operation performed in the best of medical hands. She cannot sue.
In that area, we are still in what I think the Reverend Smith would call certain extreme types of cases. I wonder... worried about the time here, whether I could move us along a bit into what I think is the more normal situation. Now, Dr. James, would you comment on this? I've seen some statements from Dr. Guttmacher about his experience at Mount Sinai from 53 to 58, 147 abortions and if my source is correct, you said that only in a few cases were those abortions really to save the woman's life. Now, the law, of course, of New York State says that it can be done only to save the life. That what they were really were cases where the woman's mental or physical health would be in danger.
Or the child's.
Or the child's. But not, they were not really obeying the law. And then you're quoted, doctor, as having said, what's happening is that this law makes hypocrites out of the doctors there. And another doctor is quoted as saying that morally the thing is even more indefensible because we're abandoning women in their greatest need. We're abandoning them to the criminal abortionists. Now, this, of course, is the, I think, the critical area of cases here. Would you comment on this kind of thing?
Yes. I don't believe there is any real justification for an abortion. Certainly not medically. With all the armamentarium we have now, we can carry these women on rather safely until they can have a living child. So that 90% of them fall into the class of psychiatry. Now, I would submit this. The moment a woman becomes pregnant, she is altered. Her body chemistry, her hormone distribution, her metabolism. This is the trigger mechanism that's going to set off a psychiatric disturbance. That is already there probably before this woman is aware she is pregnant. And I'm not quite sure at all that a spontaneous abortion, a therapeutic abortion, would differ one bit than if this woman carried to term.
I don't know whether I can comment on this, but the breakdown of the Mount Sinai figures that Professor Goldman has referred to, in 100 abortions done, therapeutic abortions done legally when I was there, 40% were on psychiatric grounds, 30% were on eugenic grounds, mainly rubella, 10% were for previous malignancy. The woman had carcinoma of the breast, for example, and had been operated upon, and her physician thought that having a pregnancy might light up metastases and she might die much more rapidly. So that actually you're not saving lives. And she would have died anyways from the metastases, so therefore we don't cause them. Certainly in the infant cases, the eugenic cases, we're not saving anybody's life. Now, in the psychiatric cases, these were cases in which the woman previously had an emotional difficulty and had received therapy and threatened suicide in this particular instance. Now, the only way that you could protect her life was either by aborting her or by incarcerating her in a mental institution. And our psychiatrist felt that she would do irreparable harm to this woman by putting her in an institution. Now, the other 20% were much more likely heart, lung, and things that we all recognize as perhaps real indications to save a life. So that's my...
We keep getting back onto this kind of a case. I think the basic problem we have, however, is the economic and the socioeconomic case.
Right.
This is the problem across the world.
I want to go there with you in a moment. I do want to get one thing clear about this sort of thing. Dr. Guttmacher, when you give these instances, you are still giving instances where clearly under the law you had the right to perform that abortion.
You see,
but I take your statement and that of a lot of other men to mean that actually many doctors today are deliberately violating the law in the name of humanity. That is, they are taking a case where clearly it is not physically or mentally
terrible. You see, you don't quite understand the fact that a doctor has to operate in a hospital.
Yeah.
And each hospital has its own rules. And the staff makes these rules. Now, at Mount Sinai, we can do abortions that the staff will allow us to do according to staff practice. At the Presbyterian or New York Hospital, we can do abortions at Mount Sinai that Presbyterian won't do. And Presbyterian will do abortions at Mount Sinai won't do because they each create their own ground rules. Now, the attitude of the district attorney is that a good hospital, like Presbyterian, Mount Sinai, or New York Hospital, they are such reliable institutions that they know they will do abortions that the staff thinks is necessary.
Isn't that a way of really skirting around the law?
Well, I depend
on your own law.
It depends what you mean by the law. In three states that I've looked, California, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania, there isn't a single prosecution of an abortion carried out in a hospital by a licensed doctor in accordance with the hospital policies.
Right.
Even though, certainly when we look technically and say the law, just looking in the books for the law, we would find that most of these abortions were illegal.
Were illegal, yes.
So, what is the law? This is a situation where we have, as in many other examples, as in of course the famous example is prohibition in this country. This is an example of an unenforced type of a legal standard, and it has all the disadvantages that go with that.
Just to try to close this point, I mean, I ask you, the Reverend Smith, if you do have a doctor in a reputable hospital who knows perfectly well that in his opinion he is not obeying the letter of the law, but who on the grounds of humanity chooses to read the law in such a way to perform an abortion which isn't, in his own opinion, strictly legal, but on the grounds of humanity, what kind of a moral problem does this present to you? It seems to me you've got two moral imperatives operating in absolute clash with each other in your mind, in your own approach to this problem.
Two absolutely differing moral imperatives?
One of them is that abortion is bad, is morally bad. Yeah. And the other one is that doing something for this woman is morally good, even though you may be violating the law.
No, I don't think that you can really push me into the position of having to choose.
No, I'm not trying to push you. I want you to comment on that kind of situation. This is what comes up all the time in this literature here.
I just don't see that. I just don't see quite what you want to have me comment.
Could I say something on this moral before we leave it? You cannot, in any practical situation in life or in law, set up one moral absolute in an entire disregard of its consequences. And in determining what is moral in this situation, I will recall a speech of Ambassador Chagla of India a few years ago in this country when he said, roughly, I'm paraphrasing him, is it moral, he was talking about the nightmare of population increase that India is going through, is it moral to condemn millions of children to a life of poverty or destitution? Is it moral that these children must be born into that condition, or is it more moral that they should not be born at all? I mean, the basic underlying problem, which we haven't touched on here at all, is the relationship of this law and this problem to the burgeoning population all across the world, including this country, only at a smaller rate, and the apparent absolute necessity for some form of population control.
Let me just comment.
I think this is the moral position. You say you look only at the sanctity of the life of the fetus within the mother. Are you going to disregard the fact that the alternative condemns 5,000 women or whatever it is to death from illegal abortionists each year? Are you going to overlook the alternative of the effect of the American policy on the world and on India?
I simply want to add this, that you're talking about the morals in U.S. say 1964.
That's right.
Morals change with times and environments. So therefore, if you were talking in Japan, it would be an entirely different discussion. And if we're talking USA 1994, we might have an entirely different discussion.
I don't think Japan is a very different problem than ours. I think we like to toss off Japan because it's a non-Christian oriented.
No, because they have a couple of million legal abortions a year, and we have 9,000.
Foot, I'd like to ask you exactly what do you want to accomplish by legalizing or relaxing the abortion law? Just what is the crux of the situation?
I think the crux of the situation is that this ought to be a determination that the parents can make themselves as to the size of their families. I think that this seems to me a morally important right for parents to have, to determine how many children they want to have and when they want to have them and under what conditions they want to have them, and to stop having them when due to economic circumstances or the health or welfare of the mother, they deem it no longer advisable to have such children. I think that also has to be viewed in the light of the fact that so far this is the only effective measure of population control on a mass application basis that we've found.
Mrs. Rossi.
Abortion.
abortion.
Yes, well, I want to just also stress one other thing, that the whole medical profession is subject merely to the non-enforcement of a law, which is a terrible thing to have over the head of any profession that is trying to be helpful to patients. And to the extent that it's possible to, I think we should not legislate in the area of morality. And if there's a gap between the legal norm and what is the actual practice in the society, I think we should move in the direction of narrowing that gap.
Well,
and it happens that this area of abortion, this is the one field of medicine that the law tells the doctor and sets limits on what he can do. In a case of something like lobotomy, which has serious effects upon character, there are no laws that restrict the medical profession with or the psychiatric profession from making a decision as to what would be best for the patient's welfare. But in this case, affecting family life most intimately, he either has to depart from the law or he has to say no. And
he
the woman
is the physician.
The physician. Or
Mrs.
the
Ross, before we get over into this economic and social question fully and to try to clean up this moral one, for me to shift to the other side for a moment here, what about the moral problem, which is brought up constantly, of relaxing these laws, and then you will, say, one group of people, encourage promiscuity among young people.
Well, can that really be serious if 90% of the illegal abortions are on married women and those who want to control the size of their family? Then I don't see that this is really something that's apt to happen. In addition, you have to face the fact, what is greater, to not permit an abortion if the individual is not married, or to permit an increase in illegitimacy rate? Which is the greater cost to the individual and to the society?
I think that's a hypocritical morality, too, because what happens is, as Kinsey's figures and other figures make perfectly clear, is that middle and upper class and educated people with some financial resources have access to abortions, and they do, in fact, get abortions by one method or another. But the lower class people, the economically deprived people, the religious minority groups, they have much less access to contraceptive techniques, they have much less access to abortion, and then when they have an illegitimate child, we slap them in the face with restriction on ADC payments or something of this sort. I think this is related to the moral issue.
Well, of course, Mrs. Rossi was using that figure, which I think came from Dr. James, that the illegal abortions are about 90% in the case of married people. Of course, these figures wobble all over the place
sure
in this material, but the ones that I see most frequently cited have about 53 or 54% in the case. This is too low.
Oh, yes.
You gentlemen would agree it's much too low. Most of it's married. So it's way up in the 80 or 90% more accurate.
And I do not think that you are going to cut down the number of illegal abortions by relaxing the law. Because human nature being what it is, these people are going to seek secrecy. They're going into someone under a false name.
Which people are you speaking of?
The people who are seeking abortion. They don't wish this to be known. They're not going to go into a good place where there's a record of the family. They'll still seek these individuals who will do this preferably outside of a hospital.
Well, this depends on the extent of the relaxation of the law. Now, in the case of a country like Denmark, with a code as far as abortion is concerned, modeled after the Scandinavian countries. It's true that here's a small country of, 4 million people, and it's estimated that with the relaxation and making abortion more possible on broadly construed humanitarian grounds, there are about 5,000 legal abortions a year, and still about 12,000 illegal.
Now, this is a very good point.
This depends on how relaxed they are. The point is that even in the Scandinavian countries, you have to be reviewed medically. There has to be good cause. And even with something which is stated in terms of sufficient reason for the preservation of the woman's health mentally and physically, it is extremely difficult for a couple where the woman has other things in life, where she's not a would-be suicide, she's not a psychotic, she's not mentally ill. And this can't be the ground which it has to be in order to have a legal abortion.
Reverend Smith,
now, I think this should be broadly, sufficiently broadly construed that it's possible for the not for those who don't want another child to have it.
You're advocating abortion as a simple birth control method.
No, not as a... By itself, no. To the extent that we can have better and better contraceptives used in your society, I should think then the incidence of abortion will go down. But until that day, and for many segments of our society, this becomes extremely difficult. You can't rely exclusively on contraception.
And the experience in Japan has been that as the abortion rate has continued high, the use of contraceptions is also steadily, contraceptive devices is also steadily increasing. Mm-hmm. So that to some extent the high incidence of abortion as a birth control device in Japan is probably a temporary phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to orient the viewer, because I'm afraid they don't quite understand what the panel does. There are three types of abortion laws, the highly restrictive laws which we have in this country, which allows two therapeutic abortions for every 1,000 children born. Then you have the mildly permissive laws, which the Scandinavian countries have in force, which allows 30 legal abortions for every 1,000 children born. And then you have the wholly permissive laws, as we have in Hungary, for example, where you have, according to Kingsley Davis, 1,390 legal abortions for every 1,000 children born. So you have to orient the listener into what we're talking about. Now, I agree that simply broadening our indications, say to the same degree that they do in the Scandinavian countries, 30 per 1,000 children born, will not materially affect the illegal abortion situation in this country. I agree entirely with my colleague from Hartford. On the other hand, as a physician, I feel we can serve the public and our patients infinitely better if the doctor is given the benediction of allowing to do abortions in these medically borderline cases, which they do in the Scandinavian countries. And I'd be very happy to see a legal abortion rate in this country of, say, 50 per 1,000 live children rather than 2. I'm not sure I'm ready for the 1,390, which one finds in Hungary, which Professor Foote apparently would agree to.
Well, I don't think we'd find that here at all, because the effect, the experience of Japan and the experience in Eastern Europe and Poland and Hungary and Yugoslavia, and the experiences Kingsley Davis and some others have pointed out of tremendously heavy abortion rates in Northwestern Europe 50 years ago, These experiences are not comparable to ours. We have already a very heavy use of contraceptive devices,
right,
presumably, and there's no indication at all that our rate, even if we completely legalized it, would go anywhere near that high. The trouble with your position of therapeutic abortion is it is certainly an improvement, but it still leaves out of account all the people whose economic condition in life is such that they can't afford the psychiatric fees to get some psychiatrist to say to a hospital board that this abortion should be terminated because of the mental condition of the mother. It's essentially a class discriminatory loosening of abortion laws.
Well, of course,
excuse me, Dr. Lamar, but would you comment on this kind of thing, because this comes up often. I've heard it put this way, in this extreme form, that if you have enough money, you can certainly get a perfectly legal abortion, because all you have to do is to go to enough doctors, and one of them, sooner or later, will say, well, psychiatrically or medically, this is not. And if you make a perfectly legal abortion.
Yeah, and this frightens me some. On a relaxation of the law, what is it going to do to the medical profession? Now, we have in our group a lot of unscrupulous doctors, just as they do in any profession. Probably not with the clergy. But in any event, I think these men are a little bit financially oriented. They're performing abortions now. And imagine what a field day they're going to have when the laws are relaxed. Well, let's dismiss them, because they've always been with us and they always will be. But now let's take the good, conscientious, ethical doctor who abides by the law, and he does. His philosophy allows him to perform what he thinks is a therapeutic abortion to save the mother's life. The laws are relaxed. He's more or less going to be coerced into doing abortions, at which he's a little bit reluctant to do. He'll have a few qualms of conscience about this the first time. The second time, it won't be quite so difficult. And that could easily go on to a good man until it'd be quite commonplace.
Well, of course, if the laws change to permit it to be commonplace in accordance with the ethics of the patient, we keep leaving the patient out of this. We keep talking about this as the doctor's decision. I think it's essentially it should be essentially the patient's decision. And just as it is at other medical practices, you talked about lobotomies as the doctor's decision, but the patient also makes a decision in medical cases. I don't think you've dealt with his question, though, of the fact that at the present time, a rich person can always get an abortion. Under an extreme circumstance, they can buy a round-trip jet tourist fare to Japan. Or they can do what Mrs. Finkbein did and fly to Sweden.
No more.
But
I don't understand that.
Well, I was in Sweden very recently, and I was told by my colleagues there not to send them any Mrs. Finkbeins.
Oh, I see.
That Sweden was not very receptive to Americans or any other people from any other countries. They were clamping down.
They did.
There's no change in the law, though.
They are changing the Swedish law, are they not, to provide specifically for this kind of a case where there's
That's
a deformed
right.
fetus.
That's right.
So, well, now we're heading here where I think we should be heading into. And if this law should be changed in any way, how should it be changed? And I have here the form recommended by the American Law Institute, which I think might provide us a focus of discussion. Now, you people who are more expert at this, correct me if I'm wrong. It has three parts, as I understand. One is that you can abort if you don't have to say any longer that the mental or physical health would be seriously endangered. You simply have to say that there will be a substantial risk. In short, you're giving much more discretion to the doctor.
You're including health and not only life.
Yes. It's shifting from saying that the person will be killed or the person will be unhealthy, really, is what it amounts to. The second case where a doctor could abort would be where something would be defective in the child. And the third would be any case of rape or incest where the person who had been raped or
impregnation of a child of 16 or less. With or without her consent.
Now, these are the three. The Reverend Smith, would you start us on that? I take it you can accept none of this from your position.
Well, you're talking in the first place about relaxing to a certain extent the definition of therapeutic.
That's right.
Most of the laws at the present time, as I understand them, say that the actual life of the person has to be seriously endangered. Now you're relaxing that.
Well, they say the life of the mother. They don't usually have the word serious, and life is a pretty
No, and it doesn't have to be
flexible.
The mother will die in birth or delivery.
It's necessary to preserve the life of the mother is the New York statute. To preserve the life of the mother. This is New York.
Yes,
no,
well, that's fairly common
state
around
state
the country in that
it's
form.
It's a very common form.
Yeah, now the first thing that this would do would be to relax that and simply say that there would be substantial risk.
To preserve the life or health of the mother, for example, is a relaxation.
Let me comment.
Mrs. Rossi, yes.
If you would like the exact wording from the
there,
model
yes.
penal code, it was that an abortion is medically advisable because continuance of the pregnancy involves substantial risk that mother or child will suffer grave and irremediable impairment of physical or mental health. This was the recommendation from the American Law Institute, and the problem has been to try to get that changed on a state-to-state basis.
I would say that because most Protestant clergymen and theologians already accept the idea and sanction the notion, the practice, and the principle of therapeutic abortion, that they would be inclined to go along with this recommendation. There are a couple of other things
about
you mentioned, however.
How about this particular Protestant clergyman over here?
I would be inclined to go along with this particular recommendation. But there were two other parts.
Excuse me, before you leave the first part, though. Now, Dr. Guttmacher, would this kind of change bring that up to that 30 in 1,000 you were talking about?
Well, in Scandinavian countries, as I recall the figure, some 40 or 50% are done for the mother's health, I think about 20% or 20 or 30% on eugenic grounds, about 7% for sex crimes, and 7% for socioeconomic indications. That's the breakdown in Scandinavia. So, that gives us 30 per thousand.
Yep.
So that if we broaden the law simply to allow a doctor to use his judgment about the mother's or child's life being impaired, using the Scandinavian experience, this would give us about 85% of the 30 that Scandinavia has, and would then, of course, give us in the area of about a 25 per thousand live births. If you're going to go the whole Scandinavian way, you'd have to add sex crime, and you'd have to add certain particularly horrendous socioeconomic situations.
Well, the Scandinavian, one provision of the Swedish law certainly goes far beyond the model penal code of the American Law Institute that we're talking about, and one of the conditions is that considering the living conditions of the mother and such other factors, her physical or mental health would be seriously impaired by birth and care of the child. I mean, that's a socioeconomic, really. It goes way beyond the
well, now, will you pardon me, sir? I want to get back here and let Mr. the Reverend Smith finish. You can accept number one in this American Law Institute thing. You can't accept two and three, is that right?
That's right.
That the child would be defective,
and,
which is number,
and number
two.
Number two, I would say this is a tragedy. And I would say that the church really has a fantastic sympathy for the unwanted, the unloved child, for the cripple, for the feeble-minded. And the church would like to do something for them, but it would not like to abort in these particular cases.
You're talking for one segment of the church. You certainly aren't saying this is a general Protestant clergyman's opinion, because I can give you, I can name off a list that would...
You can name off a list, but I would like to see them say this in print. I've been looking for statements, and I have not been able to find them.
Well, I'll give you one statement. At the time, you remember that Belgian woman who was prosecuted for infanticide, for she and her doctor for killing, what was her name, Suzanne somebody, a couple of years ago. At that time, there was a poll in England which was 2-1 in favor of legalizing abortion.
Among ministers?
Among the general public,
yes,
which is predominantly Protestant, I assume, or at least a majority Protestant. And the Radio Luxembourg took a poll of its listeners as to whether or not she should be acquitted, and they, out of about 7,000 votes, it was about 7-1 in favor of acquittal.
You're still
the
in the York,
question
though,
is this. I want to see the, and you asked about clergymen and about Protestant theologians. You're not asking about the parishioners. I think these are two separate questions, and the notions and the principles and the reasoning that are used by both groups of persons are quite different.
Dr. James, and of course you would not accept this, and you basically cannot accept it on purely religious grounds. It's all out, isn't it?
And a bit of fair play.
The pragmatic ground.
Exactly. And then I would say...
Is there any medical ground that you would...
Well, there's one medical affair here. I mean, medicine is not a true science. Really? I mean, everything is unpredictable in medicine, even to the outcome of a simple surgical procedure. No one can predict that this child is going to be deformed. No one.
You can predict it within 20% accuracy.
Perhaps.
No.
But again, I'd rather play with the 80% than the 20.
Well, there it is. There's the proposal, and I think we have the positions perfectly clear on that kind of proposal. Before we run out of time, we only have about 10 minutes. May I move us to what I think has to be brought in here someplace? The argument of a lot of people that basically this problem is not one that's going to be solved or not solved by laws. It has to do with the home. One distinguished doctor, Dr. Lewis Hellman, remarked in part of this literature that if abortion were made legal in the U.S. in the present state of attitudes, there wouldn't be enough hospital beds to accommodate all the patients. Well, now, regardless of whether that's true or not, this becomes part of this argument, which is put this way by Dr. Saul Gusberg at Mount Sinai. You probably know him.
He succeeded me.
Quite well, since he did succeed you. He said, I believe we are having a sexual revolution in this country, and I believe this is entirely due to parents' lack of communication with their children. Parental permissiveness in everything a child does, including relationships with the opposite sex, is now showing up among other ways, in this alarming rise of criminal abortions being performed by amateurs. In short, this is, it's in the home, says he, that really the cause of all this is. I gather you don't agree with him particularly on this.
Well, I think that there are many factors. The home certainly is one factor. But if we're going to talk about the sexual revolution, which should be the topic of another session, I certainly think we're right in the midst of it. The home is partly responsible, certainly also the emancipation of a woman, the fact that she, and I think quite rightly, asked for a single-sex standard, all these things, the outlawing of legal prostitution, all these things have contributed to this. So we're right in the midst of this sexual revolution, and we're having the sex mores change right under our nose, whether we like it or not. So I agree with the factors, but I wouldn't like to blame it all on the home. The home is only one of the factors.
Well, I think this is a whipping post here. We know perfectly well that we have undergone and are undergoing an economic revolution and a tremendous urbanization of our culture. And we know that for the advances that allow us to have TV programs like this, that we are also paying very heavy prices, a tremendous increase in crime, a tremendous increase in illegitimacy. Whether there's a tremendous increase in unjustified abortions, I don't know, because the
illegal abortions
were apparently pretty high earlier. But we know that it's leading to a disintegration of the home, and it's leading to higher divorce statistics. These are factors which accompany a very fundamental change of life. They're the price we're paying for what we're getting out of life generally. And it is fine to talk about resurrecting the home, but how do you resurrect the home in an urban culture where so much of its purpose?
Because, Mr. Foote, what these people are talking about is the reverse, I think, of this, namely that there is a sex revolution going on out there, and that the parents simply haven't talked to their children, communicated with them, and given them any kind of structure.
And as long as the parents haven't done it, the schools ought to do it.
And the schools don't do it.
And therefore,
you get all these cases cited of these 16, 17-year-old kids who end up pregnant, and then they want to get an illegal abortion. I mean, this is the way the argument is running in this case. And I want to be fair to Dr. Gusberg. I certainly didn't mean to imply that he made this the only reason or the only cure. He just wants that emphasized on... Mrs. Rossi, I think you were going to comment.
Yes, I think, as Dr. Goodmarker says, that this is a topic for quite another kind of another panel session. But if, for those of us who believe that there should be relaxation of the law, could we speak a bit about who should carry the ball in this? To my knowledge, there is no equivalent in the United States to the English Abortion Law Reform Association. This has been a problem on a state basis. For those who have drafted the state version of a revision of the penal code, their experience, I am informed, has been that there is a very active, vigorous minority who opposes it, and no groups come forth to support the sections applying to abortion. Now, unless there is some increase in the majority view, which I think is the majority view in the United States, we can't expect...
Wait a minute. No, I lost that. The majority view is, in your opinion, favors relaxation of the law.
I don't think we know what the majority view is.
No.
We know, and I'm not sure we can trust the majority view. The majority view in polls is that divorce should be very strict, but the majority practice, in actuality, is to expect lawyers to get them quick and easy divorces despite the restrictions they insist on in the books, and I suspect the same practice is here. We should have strict laws against abortion, but if I or my daughter want an abortion, I want to be able to get it.
Yes, well, this depends a little bit how you do your research. If you ask, are you in favor of relaxing the abortion laws, I suspect that a poll would show a very sizable proportion of the Americans saying no, because this is a value-laden term. If instead you suggested situations, as we did when we started the panel today, then you'd get an indication of opinion. Yes, good heavens, a woman who has been raped and is pregnant as a result, it should be legally possible for her to obtain an abortion, and the law should so provide. So I think we have to be careful on what the kind of data, what the evidence is, for what the majority view is.
You certainly do, you know. The Reverend Smith, who was worried about that instance, actually I left out in reciting that here one fact that was in that case, that she was raped by a Negro, because this would have introduced even more emotional elements into the thing. And of course, as you say, you can practically predict your answers when you...
Yeah, I think you can, by the way in which you pose the questions. And surely, as I say, most Protestant clergymen and theologians favor and sanction therapeutic abortion. There's a great question as to sex crimes. The Christian Century magazine editorialized some time ago and in favor of abortion in those cases. But these are the minority of cases. And in all of the other cases, abortion does not seem to be the answer. We seem to be looking for a cheap and easy and quick, fast solution to some very grave problems, and the church is not saying that there are
You two people would deal with the grave problem of the increase of the world population. You have every time I've tried to raise this, this seems to me much the most relevant criterion to the whole discussion of abortion law.
And you're leaving out the child, and you're leaving out the woman and the husband discussion at the moment.
What are we going to do in terms of this tremendous increase, where just between 1950 and 1980, in many parts of the world, the population is doubling?
Sir, we have only about 45 seconds. Do you want to comment on this point that Mr. Foote's so anxious to have you comment on?
Well, I'd be reluctant to see the medical profession have to control the economics. However, if they must play a part in it, I think we should come up with something better than homicide.
And the Reverend Smith, please, on this point.
I would say that we have a grave problem here, and abortion is not the answer to it. There must be some method of birth control that is more humane, more in keeping with the human mode of being than abortion is.
I am sorry, gentlemen. I'm sorry, Mrs. Rossi. We are cut off. I'll be back in just a moment. For this discussion, may I thank you, the Reverend Robert H. Smith, pastor of the Church of Our Redeemer in Chappaqua, New York. Dr. Ellen F. Guttmacher, president of Planned Parenthood World Population and former director of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. Dr. Louis P. James, chief of the Obstetrical and Gynecological Department of the St. Francis Hospital in Hartford. Mrs. Alice S. Rossi, research associate of the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago. And Mr. Caleb Foote, professor of family and criminal law at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you for being with us, ladies and gentlemen, and goodbye for this week.